Okay, I just wondered, and I'll just ask you, would you rather do those readings right away, and we can put them in wherever? That way you could not have to worry about the copy?
Sure, that seems like a good way to go.
Okay. If you would just do a small introduction to each one, you know,
okay,
just to say what it is. And, you know, we're looking for not a lot, but
sure,
they're both such nice stories that it would be good to get you.
Okay, good. Okay. I'm going to read from the opening of my short story, 9 Inches. It's the title story of a collection that's coming out in September. 9 Inches. Ethan didn't want to go to the middle school dance, but the vice principal twisted his arm. He said it was like jury duty. The system only made sense if everybody stepped up and nobody got special treatment. Besides, he added, you might as well do it now, get it over with before the new baby comes and things get even crazier. Ethan saw the logic in this, but it didn't make him feel any less guilty about leaving the house on Friday evening with the dishes unwashed and Fiona just getting started on her nightly meltdown. Apparently, her busy toddler day wasn't complete unless she spent an hour or two shrieking her head off before bedtime. Dana smiled coldly at him from the couch, as if he'd volunteered to be a chaperone out of spite, just to make her life that much more difficult. Don't worry about us, she called out as he buttoned his coat. We'll be fine. She had to speak in a louder than normal voice to make herself heard over Fiona, who was standing in the middle of the living room in yellow Dr. Denton's, her fists balled and her face smeared with a familiar glaze of snot, tears, and unquenchable fury. No, Daddy, she bellowed. You stay home. I'm sorry, Ethan said, not quite sure if he was apologizing to his wife or his child. I tried to get out of it. Dana scoffed, as if this were a likely story. She was usually a more understanding person, but this pregnancy wasn't bringing out the best in her. Only 5 months along, she'd already begun groaning like a martyr every time she hoisted herself out of a chair or bent down to tie her shoe. She was also sweating a lot, and her face had taken on a permanent pink flush, as if she were embarrassed by her entire life. Ethan couldn't say he was looking forward to the next several months, or the next several years, for that matter. Love you guys, he said, inching toward the door.
Thank you. That was very nice.
Oh, sure. Thank you. Next is, I'm sorry, I'll be reading from Diem Perditi by Julie Otsuka. This is a story that was originally published in Granta that I chose for the Best American Short Stories of 2012. Diem Perditi by Julie Otsuka. She remembers her name. She remembers the name of the president. She remembers the name of the president's dog. She remembers what city she lives in, and on which street, and in which house. The one with the big olive tree where the road takes a turn. She remembers what year it is. She remembers the season. She remembers the day on which you were born. She remembers the daughter who was born before you. She had your father's nose. That was the first thing I noticed about her. But she does not remember that daughter's name. She remembers the name of the man she did not marry, Frank, and she keeps his letters in a drawer by the bed. She remembers that you once had a husband, but she refuses to remember your ex-husband's name. That man, she calls him. She does not remember how she got the bruises on her arm or going for a walk with you earlier this morning. She does not remember bending over during that walk and plucking a flower from a neighbor's front yard and slipping it into her hair. Maybe your father will kiss me now. She does not remember what she ate for dinner last night or when she took her medicine. She does not remember to drink enough water. She does not remember to comb her hair. She remembers the rows of dried persimmon that once hung from the eaves of her mother's house in Berkeley. They were the most beautiful shade of orange. She remembers that your father loves peaches. She remembers that every Sunday morning at 10, He takes her for a drive down to the sea in the brown car. She remembers that every evening, right before the 8 o'clock news, he sets out 2 fortune cookies on a paper plate and announces to her that they are having a party. She remembers that on Mondays, he comes home from the college at 4, and if he is even 5 minutes late, she goes out to the gate and begins to wait for him. She remembers which bedroom is hers and which is his. She remembers that the bedroom that is now hers was once yours. She remembers that it wasn't always like this.
Both of those are extraordinary stories, and it is always hard to ask someone to read and then stop. You want it to go
right.
On.
Well, you know, I thought there was a nice ending with she remembers it wasn't always like this. So I realized that that was a good place to go to.
What I like about that story, I think, one of the many things that I like about that story is that it seems to be only one thing and develops into another and another and another while maintaining the first story all the way through. It's a masterwork.
It really is. It's a tour de force. And you know, she hardly ever breaks from that, what seems like a really restrictive pattern of just she remembers, she doesn't remember. And yet, in the course of all those memories and forgettings, you know, the reader slowly puts together a story of an entire life.
Yeah. So what is it, do you think, that makes a great short story?
I was afraid you were going to ask me that. you know, I think, and I really learned this when I edited Best American Short Stories, which required me to read, you know, quite widely in what had been published in the year 2011, was that, you know, you can have a certain preconceptions about that, but it really is that old, I know it when I see it. You suddenly feel that that excitement and that alertness and that need to know what happens next, or just that excitement to be hearing a voice that you've never heard before, or learning about a place or a person that you didn't think you'd ever meet. So I don't know. I mean, I think the one thing for me that's always been true is that there's a germ of an anecdote in a lot of the stories I like. And that, I've always loved listening to people tell me interesting stories about what happened. And I think some of the stories I like best begin with what seems like a kind of a curious anecdote, and then uses that anecdote to reveal not only, you know, character in the moment, but the story of an entire life.
Short stories are such an extraordinary challenge. I know you've been writing for a long time, reading for a long time. Short stories demand that you do so much with so little, and you have to do it well because failure is waiting for you right around the corner, isn't it? If you don't tell the story now and in plain language, disaster is somewhere nearby.
Well, it's true that it's a very unforgiving form. It does seem to me that, you know, stories that work have to be pretty close to perfect. I think, you know, the novel is a much more forgiving form, where I think we just take it for granted that every novel we read will be flawed in a certain way, and that what we want really is just for the virtues of the novel to allow us to forgive those flaws. But if a story's flawed, I think it's, and you leave it for even a moment, I think it can be hard to get back into it. And I think it can be, you know, a very kind of delicate machine, that's a narrative machine that a writer's trying to create.
In the introduction to The Best American Short Stories 2012, you write that you have vivid memories of the first time you read a short story by Raymond Carver. Can you tell me about that? Was Fat,
yeah,
wasn't it?
It was Fat, which is the, if my memory serves, is the first story in the collection, Will You Please Be Quiet, Please? And I think what I was talking about in the introduction was, you know, I was a young writer. I had a wonderful education at Yale. I had come from a working-class town in New Jersey. And I think I was just confused about what kind of writer I could become and what my audience might be. And I was sort of divided between this sort of, you know, populist sense of wanting to belong and write for the community that I grew up in, and this maybe more elitist sense that you get at an Ivy League university that there's a sophisticated literary audience out there that you're writing for. And I could immediately see that Carver was writing about working class people in a way that working class people could understand if they were willing to open the book and read it. But that other things were happening that would be completely satisfying to the most sophisticated literary reader. And it seemed in one, you know, stroke to solve this dichotomy that was baffling me as a writer and reader.
I think it's important to say that this was in the early 1980s, when the literary heroes of the time were much more experimental than Carver, Thomas Pynchon.
And Pynchon was the writer who most bothered me at the time, because there was a kind of unanimity among my English professors that he was, without a doubt, the great American writer of the era. And, you know, I just found him very difficult to read. And I think what I've come to see now is that this is a kind of eternal debate in American literature. I mean, you could see it in the Faulkner versus Hemingway. You could see it in the, you know, Pynchon versus Cheever, and you could see it again in, you know, Carver versus David Foster Wallace or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I do think American readers tend to take sides, but that there are occasionally writers who can bridge that gap and appeal to both the, you know, plain language, democratic audience and the sort of elite literary audience.
So tell me about this moment that established that for you. Tell me what Fat is about, the Raymond Carver story.
Fat is a there's so many levels in the telling. There's a waitress from a diner, and she's telling her friend about a fat man who comes to the diner, and he seems he just keeps ordering a huge amount of food, and other people who work at the diner, including her boyfriend Rudy, who's a chef, mercilessly mock this fat man. But she feels a strange empathy for him, and she's really kind to him, and she's trying to explain this empathy to her friend. And then at the end of the story, she just stops, and she's telling about being home with Rudy, the chef who she lives with, who's her boyfriend, being in bed, and Rudy basically forces himself on her sexually, and she has this sort of beautiful self-protective epiphany where she says, you know, when he did that, I felt that I was fat, so fat that Rudy was just a tiny thing and hardly there at all. And there's some sense that this compulsion that this man has is also a form of strength and a form of self-protection. And this anecdote that is about this mysterious episode of compassion also turns out to be a way for her to kind of protect herself from what's awful about her life. And the story ends with her saying, you know, my life is going to change. I feel it. And there's this terrible ambiguity there, because you can't tell if she thinks she's pregnant or she's free. She can't quite tell either. And so it's a very complex and sophisticated story, and one that kind of resonates after you finish it. And it's only about 3 or 4 pages long, I think.
It's the same kind of story you're talking about, though, isn't it? It's one that can be read more or less as a straight story, but that on consideration has depths available to you as you read it.
Absolutely, and it really is told. It's told. You know, she says, you know, I'm talking to my friend Rita, and this is what I tell her. And then the story is narrated in the kind of voice of someone just telling their friend about a funny thing that happened at work. And yet, you know, it starts to take on this sort of metaphorical weight as it goes on. And I really just love that sense of a story being sneaky, of telling you far more than it seems to be telling you.
But what I think I like about stories like that, and perhaps you can tell me whether you agree or not, is that they make those depths available to you. Sometimes writers don't do that. The stuff is there, but they're saying, essentially, I know more about this than you do. And if you find out the good stuff, that's because you're smart. But if you don't,
well, you know, that's the challenge of this sort of minimalist writing, which tends to leave out a lot of the signposts that, you know, readers get used to. Oh, there's a symbol, or there is an important moment. You know, some minimalist writers will leave all that out and they won't underline it. And if they're good and the story's successful, the reader will be able to intuit that and feel that accumulation of weight and meaning. But if they're not, or if there's something wrong with the story, it just remains sort of dead on the surface. I do think that's a problem with that kind of story written by someone who doesn't have Carver's sense of nuance and ability to kind of break through the surface to this hidden depth.
So we've established that you are a great admirer of Raymond Carver. I was surprised to read that when you first encountered David Foster Wallace, whom everyone seems to agree is one of the great literary talents of the 20th century, you didn't like him very much.
Well, you know, I think that I was looking at the world as a self-proclaimed follower of the Carver and Hemingway school of, you know, what I call, you know, plain language American writing. And here comes David Foster Wallace, who is, you know, clearly the smartest guy in the room and someone who is, you know, writing 1,000-page novels with, you know, a couple hundred pages of footnotes there. And I think it seemed to me like, you know, I had seen something like this before, and I had, you know, kind of staked my own identity as a writer on the exact opposite pole of the literary spectrum. And it took me a long time to get past the surface objections to him and see that, you know, in many ways he was kind of a prophetic figure. He was someone who saw what was happening in the information age that we were all just beginning to live through at that point, and could see far down the road to the kind of psychic burdens that we'd have to face.
What was it?
So I think he was a prophet of sorts.
What was it, do you think, that led you to change your mind about David Foster Wallace?
Well, interestingly, for me, it was the essays that he wrote. So it was, I think I was maybe a lot more able to see his genius in nonfiction than I was in fiction, partly because I think that even now when I read his fiction, you know, I don't read it for the characters, I don't read it for the stories, I read it for the writer's voice and the writer's consciousness. And I still feel like I do want characters and I do want story when I read fiction. And so I came to appreciate him as a sort of all-around writer, maybe in the same way that I appreciate someone like Norman Mailer, who I think in many ways is a better social observer than fiction writer.
You, of course, were faced with quite a challenge putting together the best American short stories for 2012. You had to read a lot, although I gather that there were a lot of stories that were taken out of contention before you started reading. Is that right?
That's right. So the way that the series is done, and it makes the guest editor's life a lot easier, is Heidi Pittler, who's the series editor, reads essentially everything. I believe reads stories in the thousands, and she narrows it down to a long list of 120, and the guest editor reads those 120 and picks 20. So it's a big job, but it's not a year-round, you know, exhaustive job. So it's possible that there were stories that I didn't see that, you know, might end up on some alternate list. But even out of those 120, it was very hard for me to narrow it down to just 20. Heidi has very good taste, and there were a number of, you know, really great stories that I just couldn't fit into my list.
When you were reading them, did you find that there was a particular style that appealed to you, were you trying to look for a variety of styles to represent the best American short stories?
You know, it's funny because I told Heidi, you know, I was interested in seeing some comic stories because I felt like they were sometimes underrepresented, and I always enjoy a funny story. And she did try to do that. And what I discovered was that some stories that are self-consciously comic weren't working for me. And I ended up, I think, choosing stories that really moved me. And I discovered that that's really what I want from a story, is a kind of emotional experience. And those were the ones that, you know, that really stuck with me. And so I think sometimes we have ideas about ourselves as readers, but when we put them to the test, we discover that, you know, our values are actually are different there. The one thing that I did notice and was very intrigued by was the fact that stories had seemed to be getting longer and more novelistic. I saw a lot of stories with multiple points of view, and stories like D.M. Perdidi that don't really focus on a moment but focus on the span of an entire life. And I thought that was an interesting glimpse of what's happening in the short story landscape right now. I think Alice Munro is the writer most responsible for opening up the story and bringing a variety of novelistic techniques into it.
That is a kind of a modern development, isn't it? I read that when you were trying to prepare yourself to do this, you went back and looked at the Best American Short Stories of 1986, which was edited by Raymond Carver. I can see why you went to look at it. And I don't imagine in those days multiple points of view would have been common.
They weren't. And it just struck me that, you know, is one of these small revolutions. I think that probably at any given time you could find that there were writers working with multiple points of view. But I think it is just telling that I have a number of them in my collection, and Carver had none whatsoever. And I remember being in, you know, fiction workshops back in the 80s, and there really was a sense that, you know, a story had a single main character and a single main event. And that word single, I think, looms over the story. The earliest theorist of the short story was Poe, and his principle is that a story has a single effect. And, you know, you can see how he does that. His effects are always horror, and everything is, you know, contributing to that. And I think that really held up as a kind of objective for story writers for a long time. And I think only now people are starting to, you know, write stories that are really about more the sweep of a whole life or the interplay of a variety of characters rather than a single moment in the life of a single character.
Did you find yourself as you went through these, you had, 120 stories you said to start with, and you had to whittle it down to 20. Did you find yourself playing favorites? Was there a story that you came across and you said, oh, that one, nothing is going to be better than that?
Well, that's actually an interesting thing. I think anyone who's ever judged a writing contest will know this experience. I think early on, you're not sure what your baseline is, and you tend to be much more open. And if a story's pretty good, you might put it on your list of, you know, this is a possible candidate. But as you progress, you start to realize, well, that was good, but it's nowhere near as good as these other three that I've chosen. And there starts to become a kind of, you know, critical mass of stories that set what you think of as the standard for the rest. And so I do think that as my standards increase as I went along, just because I realized just how good a good story could be.
I know that you chose 20 stories you are proud of. I have to ask, is there one you like the best?
I wouldn't want to single out one, but I think there are a couple of stories that really do qualify as masterpieces in here. Alice Munro's Axis is a story that I think anyone who wants to write fiction really needs to study, and just to see how a writer can compress the story of three intimately connected lives over the space of 50 years with just, you know, two or three anecdotes. It's really quite remarkable story. I think George Saunders' 10th of December is just an extraordinarily moving and funny story, and really a kind of a one-of-a-kind piece.
These are two of the great names in short story writing right now. In fact, I get the sense that you think Alice Munro essentially changed the world of short story writing.
I do. I think that a Munro story feels different from any other story in the way that, you know, a Cheever story feels different from someone else's story, and a Hemingway story feels different from any other. And I think there are, you know, very few writers who achieve that kind of singularity and also have a kind of profound formal influence on other writers. So I think she really does qualify as a sort of game-changing writer these days.
You said that anybody who wants to write short stories should read hers as an example. But you could tell, couldn't you, if somebody tried to write an Alice Munro short story?
Oh, yeah. And I think, you know, that's always the danger when any writer is extremely influential. And I think it's one of the reasons why there's been a little bit of a sort of backlash against Carver. He was so influential in the 80s and into the 90s. And I think he, like Hemingway, it seemed easy to do what he was doing. Of course, it turns out to be incredibly hard to do what he was doing. And there were a lot of bad imitators. And I think it's taken a little while to shake out. And I think Carver's uniqueness will come back into focus soon. But I think there was a kind of movement away, not away from Carver, but away from the legions of Carver imitators coming out of creative writing programs. And maybe that will be the case with Munro in the next decade as well.
There's been a lot of positive talk about your collection, but there's also a reviewer, and this isn't non-positive, who wrote that this year's edition of the Best American Short Stories is not a book of love stories, but it is the first volume in this series in a number of years to include so many explorations of our frank longing for relationships, our earnest if misguided attempts to make them work and to deal with the quandaries they bring to our lives. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, I guess I'd have to go back and look at other ones to see if there was something, you know, emotionally or qualitatively different about the ones that I chose. It may be that those are the kind of stories that I'm drawn to. And you know, my sense is the story is often about human loneliness and the attempt to transcend that and to connect. The story seems really well suited for that. I think it's very hard to have a story that isn't about connection, or at least the longing for connection. So I'd be very surprised if that was unique to this collection. But it's certainly one of those things that I read for. So it's maybe not a surprise that that's what I found.
I'm curious now that I know you've read all of these stories. You've been writing long enough that you have your own style. You may be aware of Raymond Carver. You may be aware of Alice Munro. Has reading these stories affected the way you think about and approach your own fiction, your own short stories, your novels maybe?
Well, I think time will tell on that. The one thing I think about my own work is that when I sit down to write, there's just a voice that's there, and it obviously was created, you know, through a lot of hard work over a long period of time, and there are a lot of other influences that contributed to it. I've noticed that once a writer forms a voice, it's hard. You can change it in superficial ways. Like, I think my sentences have become longer, and I've become less sort of strict about, you know, wanting to be completely accessible, or to write, you know, really sort of crystal clear sentences. There have been some changes. I've loosened up some as a writer, but those things never feel like conscious choices. I think they're responses to a lot of reading and a lot of personal changes. But I've never, as a sort of full grown writer, never felt like I'm changing my voice right now as a result of, you know, reading this particular story or this particular group of stories or that novel. I think of my voice as a little more like a personal signature at this point, and kind of harder to alter.
We've talked a lot about writing. Let's talk about reading just briefly. Why do we read fiction?
Well, you know, in the introduction to the book, I was sort of talking about just that sort of cognitive excitement of reading good fiction. I really do feel like it's this sort of complex mental act that, you know, really kind of brings your whole person into this state of heightened alertness. I just feel like for those of us who love to do it, it's almost an addiction. I have to read some period every day. It's almost a form of meditation for me, where I feel, I mean, it's the opposite of meditation, where you empty your head. It's sort of like you enter some story and you're just fully engaged in a way that almost nothing else fully engages me. Certainly, you know, watching a movie is mesmerizing, but I don't always feel as fully engaged in a dialogue with a movie as I do with a book. So part of the reason we read is, I think, just for that intellectual and emotional excitement that comes from good fiction. And then I think there is a way in which, you know, when you're young, you read to learn about life. And even now, you know, I'm reading fiction to enter into the minds of characters that I might never meet, or get a glimpse inside of cultures that I can only know from the outside. It really, for those of us who love fiction, I think it really becomes our best way of understanding the world.
Tom, thank you very much.
Oh, well, thanks, Jim.
Before you go, I need to ask you a question that you're not going to answer because you already have.
Okay.
It's one of those things we tack in. I'd really like to have you read an excerpt from one of your own short stories. What have you chosen for us?
I'm going to read the story 9 Inches, which is the title story of my new collection, which will be coming out in September.
Great. Doug has one more thing he'd like me to catch up on. Would you hold, please?
Oh, sure.
The Diem Perditi.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Oh, sure.
I will just obviously in order to incorporate it into the recorded conversation. There's been a lot of attention paid to electronic books now and the effect that those may be having on short stories. What do you think of the state of short stories these days?
Well, I can't tell if there's been a sea change or if we just happen to be in the midst of a really great year for story collections. There just seem to have been an inordinate number of really great collections come out over the period of a few months. I think the fact that they've done really well will at least change publishers' attitude toward them, because I think in the past it was considered a truism in publishing that it was much harder to sell a collection of stories than it was to sell a novel, and so there was a kind of a bias toward the novel. And to the extent that this year's amazing crop of story collections will change that, I think that's great.
I have to say that I like collections like the Best American Short Stories because it provides a variety. I think it's a harder sell sometimes to have one author's collection. of stories?
That could be. I think the Best American offers a kind of survey of the field that is really interesting. I know when I used to teach writing, I found it to be a really great book to use because one of the just implicit lessons in it, of course, is that there's more than one way to write a really good short story. And here are 20 different writers, you know, tackling this challenge. And you can see that what your job as a writer is to develop your own style and your own approach. So you're right. I think the anthology offers a different kind of pleasure, and the collection of a single writer, you've got to really like that writer to go in there. But that's the same truth for a novel, right?
Absolutely. Again, thank you. Oh, and I have to put in this one other question so that we can get to your Otsuka story.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like you to read just a little bit of one of the stories in the collection, the 2012 collection of the Best American Short Stories. What have you chosen for us?
I'm going to read a little bit from the beginning of Julie Otsuka's story, DM Perdidi, which was originally published in Granta magazine.
Great. Terrific. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Such a nice job.
Oh, good. Well, I enjoyed talking to you. It sounds like it's going to be a great show.
Hope so. We always hope so. It's kind of putting together a book, you know?
Yeah, I know. I bet. Well, it's really great that you guys are, having something dedicated to the story like this.
Well, as you say, this is a great time for the short story.
It sure is.
Thanks again.
Thank you very much.
All right.
I look forward to hearing the show.
Great. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.